Greetings, fellow Noel Stagics. Anne Sleeman here to say that the Christmas Specials We Love podcast is so saddened by the loss of Matthew Perry. As you know, at CSWL, our hosts hail from so many generations, and no recent show touched as many generations so profoundly as Friends, including Matthew Perry's beloved character, Chandler Bing. The funny one will long be a favorite of ours and so many others. While we will most likely cover other Friends episodes in the future, for now, we rewind to our last year's coverage of the Friends Thanksgiving. Rest in peace, Matthew Perry.
Well, hello there. Oh, I've got lots of letters for Santa today. And every year, they're the same. Some ask for toys, but a lot ask questions.
A yo-yo?
If you wish to give me a present?
I'd like to be a dentist.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Christmas Specials We Love podcast. It's myself, Kelsey, Ann, Elaine, and my very dear friend, Christian Blatt from the Blattcast. Tonight, we're going to take a little bit of a different place, and we're not going to go as far back in time as we normally do. We're going to be covering the very first Friends Thanksgiving, and I don't know if there's time, maybe we'll do a wee bit more. If there's time, maybe we will do Seinfeld as well.
Wow.
Just because back in the day, that was the Thursday night block. You would have Friends, then you'd have Seinfeld. So anyway, we thought that this would be something to do that would prep you more for the Thanksgiving holidays. We are the Christmas Specials We Love, but after this, it probably will be the Mad Dash of holidays. Although, I'm just going to say, I love my Dunkin' Donuts, but one of the things I look forward to for all the coffee companies is I like to see my holiday cups, and I do not have a holiday cup. Oh, okay, I see Christian has one from Starbucks. Very nice.
But it's the reusable from a few years ago. So
Then that doesn't count.
Mine has a snowman.
It still is fun.
Oh, yeah. You know what? Kelsey does have the snowman on hers. So
on your Dunkin' Donuts one. Yep. Okay, all right, we're getting there, people.
I have like a 12-year-old water bottle with stickers all over it. But
Ann, in Florida, are you noticing the holiday cups coming in?
Not yet. Maybe because it's still in the high 80s. So I haven't even been buying coffee at Starbucks or Dunkin' or any other coffee shop. So
you
maybe
seen
I'll do that tomorrow.
These are the important things.
Mm-hmm. It's important.
All right, you guys.
But can I just interject? I love that we may be leading from Friends right into Seinfeld, because when this show first aired, November 17th, 1994, that's the same day that Seinfeld aired their Thanksgiving special. So we're already like in sync with the two shows
at
the same time.
Yeah, I read that in the show notes. And Kevin, I was a little disappointed that you didn't also assign the Thanksgiving themed episode of The Single Guy and Veronica's Closet, or possibly Caroline in the City, you know, the whole Thursday night.
Christian, he was protecting me because I'm not a sitcom kid. And all of a sudden
I think they didn't get I don't think you got Christian's sense of humor or the joke. And again, I'm looking at all these blank faces. But back at that time, these were all the other middle of the road sitcoms that kind of come and go. And you may
they got
they
propped up
TV.
By yes. Seinfeld. Well, first Seinfeld and Cheers, and then Seinfeld and Friends propped up these other shows. Veronica's Closet and Caroline in the City went into syndication. They were on for like 6 years because they had that time slot where people are like, I don't want to change the channel. I want the other show. So
they were carried. Yeah.
I've never heard of
So we'll just get a little TV 101.
I lived through it.
So Christian, let's give them a little TV 101 where we've got, there was a criticism with the NBC executives that they were spending too much on Seinfeld and too much on Friends. But their argument was always, we're not just spending it on that 1 hour. We're spending it on the 3 hours after that. That Thursday night block was so precious. So they would build, it's called tempo programming, but they build programming
around that. And don't forget
that 10
o'clock was ER. So
and then
they
you had ER. So
night.
You would, right. It was night. A monster. Yeah. I mean, they owned that for over a decade. And I think if you go back to even the Cheers day, didn't they also have the Thursday night? Wasn't that NBC as well, right?
Yeah, so I think Cheers was on at 9 o'clock, and then Seinfeld was after it. And then when Cheers ended, Seinfeld moved back to 9 o'clock, and it became a little bit more of a dead zone, but people just watched.
And this is what they called it, appointment viewing, because people had to be in. And did you have to be in on your Thursday night to watch this?
Yeah. It was my freshman year of college, so obviously I didn't really have anything better to do than watch what they started calling a few years after these episodes, must-see TV.
Must-see TV.
You couldn't go out. I mean, you could go out after,
But okay, yeah, so I was not in that crowd. My roommates at the time in 94 were part of the must-see TV preset and yeah. all stayed in on Thursday night. I had a tendency to still be going back with the Thirsty Thursday mantra
you,
of college. And I was, like I said, this is the first time I saw this Friends episode. And I haven't seen all the Seinfelds either. So I was new to this. So old with a fresh view.
Elaine and Kelsey, because I think the next block we'll do at some point is going to be Office and Modern Family. I think these are the kind of pairings we're thinking of. But your generation has fallen in love with Friends and many of you Seinfeld as well, but definitely Friends. So, yeah. Kelsey, what were your thoughts on?
On both of them. So it's funny. I have watched both of these episodes before, but not in a minute. So I kind of forgot. So they were both entertaining. I liked Friends more if I had to pick between the two. I thought it just kind of kept me going. It was faster paced than the Seinfeld episode. I really liked them both. But yeah, Friends always makes me laugh more. Like, I love Jerry and I love Elaine, but everyone, I don't know. It was slower to me this episode.
Lainey, what about you from Gen Z?
I loved Friends growing up. I think I just binge watched it one year. I was just like, I'm bored. I'm going to binge watch Friends. And I just watched it all immediately. And it's like one of my comfort shows that I continuously go back to. So I've watched that Friends episodes multiple times. I do have a favorite Thanksgiving episode, and I hope we get to cover it one of these days. The first one was not my favorite, but right. I did. But like, they are still my comfort characters that I go back to constantly.
Comfort characters. Wow. Yeah.
Seinfeld, never really watched. I only started watching because somebody told me their name was Elaine on there, and I started watching it. I think I got through a couple episodes of season one, but yeah, I liked
it. It was fun to watch Elaine watch it.
Well, season one was almost not even going to be renewed. You know, you got to go season two on, and this was season five or six. Christian, right? Season six was the Thanksgiving Day.
Was season six,
which wasn't necessarily a Thanksgiving Day special. I want to make that clear because the Seinfeld writers would probably stab us because they were all about we're never going to show a hug. We're never going to have a very special episode. They wanted to be the anti-sitcoms, but it takes place on Thanksgiving Eve. So this is the closest thing we have.
Before we get into it, I just want to point out that it's funny. Elaine and Kelsey, you guys are so on trend with your generations and Friends. There was actually a poll this past January, and Friends won the all-time greatest show, according to those polled in America. Yeah, it was commissioned by YouTube. So you guys are right on trend. Not surprising. Yeah,
well, I think when those things come down, what's a little tragic for the writers and the creators, I think it's going to come down rather than, a critical view, but a fan view. You know, it's funny. Boston was always very highbrow in terms of their taste. And there was a Boston top 10 of TV and a national one. And Boston top 10 was always Seinfeld and those kind of shows. National top 10 was always Home Improvement. And I know when Monty Python's came to the United States in the early 1970s to perform, they were not received very well around the country. The place that they always were received from the early 70s on was Boston. My point is, if Boston did that poll, I'm not so sure it would be Friends. In our industry, I feel like it's I Love Lucy and maybe Honeymooners Christian for the classic era.
Sure.
And I think the second era, if there is one, would be Seinfeld as the kind of grandfather of all modern comedy that spun out of that. We wouldn't see, I see Friends as really super funny, great arcing characters, great story. And again, I can see the attraction, but in terms of disrupting the system, the way I Love Lucy and Honeymooners did, that's what Seinfeld did for this.
Well, Kev, as a Bostonian, do you prefer Friends or Seinfeld?
Good question.
Well, I don't compare them.
Okay.
I feel like Seinfeld is a pure comedy. And this is more of it's not a dramedy because it's not drama first. But if we get, Christian, you're clever enough to figure out a term for comedy first, drama second. But there's story, there's arcing, the characters grow, they change.
It's more accessible. I mean, Friends, it's more like your popcorn movie, your blockbuster movie. Everybody's going to be happy with it. As I've gotten older, as I moved out of the New York area, I was shocked at the amount of people who had never seen Seinfeld, whereas I just thought everybody watched it. But as it turns out, they did. My wife, to this day, has still never seen an episode. But in our house, and it was very useful for this, was the physical media of the DVD set of the first complete season of Friends. So she and her roommates would watch these all the time in college. What Elaine was talking about, the sort of like comfort television. When I saw in the show notes that I guess the DVD had some more jokes in it than the streaming version, I actually watched both of them. There's a couple more minutes. There's a couple of jokes that, you know, aren't the funniest jokes in the show, but it was kind of interesting in that way. I don't want to get off on the tangent here, but the thing that always surprises me when I watch Friends, and the reruns are on constantly on TBS, and they're usually on at the gym and I'm reading them on closed caption, I am surprised Kelsey and Elaine, not so much the two of you, but you're part of a generation that I would have expected to find Friends to be cancelable because of its toxic masculinity.
When you watch the show,
this episode alone looks more like a man slash woman. And I'm like, there's a lot of jokes throughout the series.
You know,
and
it's funny
though, because to me, Phoebe is the only masculine character in the whole series. Joey and Phoebe.
Right. But you know, it's funny, but it's a little high low, Christian, because for all of those moments, there's tons of progressive moments as well.
Absolutely.
Which is why I think the younger generation plugs in. Before we break down the scenes, I want to go to Anne for what she found for background. I know of the 9 Thanksgiving episodes that Friends did, this was the first. And Variety ranked this one number 6. And many people thought this was the best, at least the best episode of season 1. Certainly not the best Thanksgiving episode. But with that, Anne, I want to turn it over to you for production notes before we do a scene-by-scene breakdown.
Thanks, Hibbs. So yeah, I saw the same thing. And then I actually looked at some other rankings of the Thanksgiving episodes. And depending on where you looked, they definitely had different rankings. So it was really clear that of the first season, this was a favorite amongst all. Directed by James Burrows, who won 11 Primetime Emmys. Created by David Crane and Marta Kaufman. One of my favorite things I found out about Marta Kaufman, she was also one of the composers of the song, and her husband, Michael Skoloff, was as well. So they helped write the famous Friends theme song that the Rembrandts went on to release. Amazing staff of writers. Jeff Strauss, known for Dream On, obviously Friends and Partners. Jeff Greenstein, known for Will and Grace, Dream On and Friends, nominated for a couple of Emmys. And countless other awards, mostly for Will and Grace, including, though, was an outstanding comedy series of Friends for 1994. Also won the Emmy for Outstanding Individual Achievement in Writing for a Comedy Series for this very episode, the one where Underdog gets away. On the writing staff, too, I noticed, I'm not 100% sure how to pronounce her name, Jenji Cohen, who is uncredited on this episode, but she's of the Orange is the New Black and Weeds fame. She was a contributing author to this as well.
See, most of these, what happens is on all these shows.
She hated working there. But
She did?
Really? Oh, yeah. Christian.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Duke.
Yeah, my wife.
Yeah, Christian.
This is very, very Christmas-like.
I don't think she's been quiet about that. I don't think it was a right fit for her, is probably. The clickbait headline would be, Jenji Cohen hated writing on Friends, but the actual story would say that she just realized it was not a fit for her. And look, you have people like Ben Stiller was on Saturday Night Live for like 3 weeks. You know, sometimes people just don't fit into the right thing.
Right.
And a lot of she time, found her thing. Yeah, but Friends wasn't it for her. Yeah.
It's good inspiration for people too, that if you are rejected or you don't, it doesn't work out in something that's amazing. That's such a perfect example of it's really not you and you got to keep swinging, because the flip happens too on these shows. And that's what I was going to say is once you're anointed with a credit like this, you tend to just get work that just falls your way. And you have to be very careful as a creator and a producer when you hire these people, because you don't really know. They're in a group of 15, 20 people. And some of these shows, it's literally one mind that's doing 80%, 90% driving the force. And everyone's kind of adding in little spices here and there. You get that. And then the other thing is with these rooms, they get very, very clicky. This was a time I was writing at MTV in the middle of all of this, when this was all exploding and everyone was writing their, we call them spec scripts, a spec version of Friends or a spec version of Seinfeld. And then you shop that around and hope that you get hired by one of these shows. But one of the problems with Seinfeld, and I don't think I've ever heard anyone mention this, they just became so tight. They became the smartest guys in the room. And I don't know if that was her experience on Friends, but sometimes you get these clique of writers that they don't let anyone else in. They don't hear any other good ideas in their own mind. Only their ideas are amazing. They're smarter than everybody. And what happened with Seinfeld was literally, and Jerry said it, like we were out of ideas. That last year for them was so painful for Jerry because they were out of ideas. And we outsiders as writers would say, how does a show about nothing run out of ideas? But that's why, because right? they stopped growing. They stopped reaching out to other people. And like I said, some of these writers get very, very clicky, and a lot of those rooms get very toxic and not collaborative. And now the new rooms, it was starting to change over where the new rooms don't have it. I'll give a shout out to Drew Carey. Probably no surprise to anyone. He would always take everyone away. He would pay for a giant cruise. I think it was cruise or some vacation. He'd pay for everyone. He took care of everyone. And then also Ray Romano, I know on his staff, you to get on the show, you had an interview almost with everybody on the staff, but it wasn't about, we don't want to let anyone in. It was, we don't want to let any jerks in. We have a nice family atmosphere, because when you get comedy writers together, it's hard because everyone's kind of a wise ass, kind of a smart ass. Everyone's got the ribs. It's kind of habitual to be poking fun at people, but then you get the ones who are nasty. They think they should have been Seinfeld. They think they should have been Ross. Most of them started out thinking they were going to be the funny one, and now they're writing, and a lot of that toxicity comes out. And so I can see why. Yeah, I've been in that position. I've been there. I've been in those rooms. Yeah, I just, I'm like, I don't belong here. With
Yeah, I was going to ask him. You guys are all nasty. Super competitive with, you know, yes. I'm funnier than you. And even just different styles of comedy.
Yes. And if you don't have a good leader who looks at it like a team, who says, hey, this is my rebounder. This guy plays great defense. This person is amazing as an outside shooter. When I had my staffs as a head writer, I was always like, hey, it's not your thing to maybe do a short film or do a sketch. But you know what? When it comes to one-liners and zingers, you're my person. I was always trying to manage everyone's strengths and go around the room that way. It's hard. And then what's really hard about those sitcoms is they play live on a Friday night. And literally, guys, maybe you were the writer who got your one joke in. And if that joke didn't play to some tired or bored audience that was loaded in from the Midwest on a Friday night, you thought you were out of a job. And you
I was going to ask if it was super awful. Competitive like that too, where you can get brutal. Clipped like at the end of the show. I was wondering actually about Genji specifically. I'm like, were her jokes not seen as funny or in the Friends genre?
Yeah, I don't know if she actually got any scripts. I mean, like Kevin's explaining, you know, a lot of times, you know, you're in the room and, you know, once the draft gets turned in, there's a lot of changes to it. And a lot of those, you know, the sitcoms, at least in pre-COVID times, the writers were all on the floor after each scene. They would then try to like, all right, let's try like 8 new jokes in some different places. And everybody's going to have to laugh just as hard and then kind of see, you know, one bit of advice. When I interned at Conan O'Brien's late night show, the head writer kind of explained that sometimes the decision would be, you know what, that joke didn't work for the 198 tourists, but we know it's funny. We're going to leave it in. And I bet the people that are watching, and you have to know which are the ones that are
right,
which are the ones that work. And which are the ones that, ooh, that was not as funny as we thought it was.
Yeah. You know? And I again, think that's right.
The you need a good Bill leader Belichick. Knows the difference.
Yeah. Right. And I'm assuming a Chuck Lorre, some of these showrunners, Mark Cronin, who's got the whole Below Deck franchise. And before that, he had all the VH1 shows. He was actually my boss. And Mark used to say, listen, you don't have to be the showrunner. You don't have to be the funniest guy. You don't have to even be the best writer, but you have to know what the best material is, and you've got to be able to pull that out of the people. And I always remembered that. But a lot of times you'll get a showrunner who's thinking he or she is the funniest and don't have the humility. And by the way, sometimes it actually is the case where you get a genius and you just have to, like Larry David, you just go, if he says, I don't care if the 9 people don't get it, put it in, you have to let Larry David, you have to let him, because maybe he will be wrong, but more than likely he's showing us he's going to be right. Anyway, should we start breaking this episode down or what, kids?
Let's do it, Kev.
We start out at the coffee shop. Rachel asks for an advance from her boss, who, Christian, this is Willie from Alf.
Yeah.
I hope the show lasts long enough that we can do an Alf Christmas. There's got to be an Alf Christmas special.
The Alf Christmas special is the underline most depressing hour of sitcom television in television
history.
Wow.
I did an episode of my podcast about it a few years ago. You think you know what you're in for? It's not. Okay. It has a laugh track.
All right,
track,
then. And make a note of that, please.
I duly noted. Duly noted. I think we'll have to cover it
you
now.
You have to.
Yeah. If we're looking to get depressed, let's watch the Alf Christmas
and
show.
And you will be.
So we have the opening joke, you're a terrible waitress. Then we go into the opening. We're all dancing at that iconic fountain that we have in L.A. What was interesting, I thought that a lot of the stuff that we see on this is a precursor of what's to come with millennials and Gen Z. For example, Rachel being this rich girl who is now independent, trying to be independent, but really has been supported by the parents up to this point. That was, what? Back then, original, unique. Today, I don't know a kid in LA that's not in some way, shape, or form living off of their parents. And then the ones that are super affluent, their big thing is, I want to be independent. But back then, that wasn't as big a thing or that you heard about. It was probably a 1% thing. Now, the majority of people I know, Christian, in LA, in some way, shape, or form, literally every one of the kids has the parents doing something for them. At least the first year or two out is completely paid for by the parent.
Yeah. And yet at the same time, she's independent, but she's asking her boss for money and she's asking her friends for money. Her friends
again,
give her money.
Is that not a precursor to?
Yeah. Oh, 100%.
100%. Yeah. She hasn't
I'm
even
$100. I have money from you instead of from my parents. Thank you.
Yeah.
And look, she wants an advance on her salary. That was like, there's things about this being 1994 that you got to wrap your head around. I'm like, what's she going to do with $100? I'm like, oh, I guess she could have bought an airline ticket to Vail in 1994 for $100.
Right, and just walk into the airport in 1994 because it was 9/11. You know, it was totally different. Yeah. On Rachel right there in that moment, do you think because of how she looks, she also gets away with asking for the advance in her salary more than if she was less attractive? Or same with, she's not good at her job and her boss just kind of laughs at it.
Oh, yeah. Any of the leads in this series would not be fired from a job at a coffee shop, no matter how bad they are.
She's floating by. Yeah. Looks. Yeah.
She's such a floater.
Back to the coffee shop. Rachel wants an advance on tips. Monica enters with Ross, Phoebe, Chandler. Monica says to Ross, Mom's going away for Thanksgiving. No, you're wrong. I'm calling Mom. Off he goes. And when Joey enters. So again, this is a big thing.
And Elaine and Kelsey, he had to leave the room. And there was a phone on the wall that he had to put change in, which is like money, but it's like a kind of money that, you know, it weighs a lot. And you put it into the phone to call his mom. Maybe he called collect. I don't know. You know what? It's too hard to explain. Just understand there was a phone in another room.
Hey, I know about that. Even though I wish I was 16, we were alive. I don't know about Elaine. I was alive when those things. We still had all the landlines and all that stuff when I was born.
Elaine, did you?
Yeah, I had landlines. I've used pay phones before.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hell yeah.
Oh, well, there we go. See?
Well, good. I'm judging
I think that experience all around.
I'm judging a DVD box set by its cover. That's my mistake.
But it's interesting, the attachment to the parents I thought was cute, and Ross just plays this great mopey.
Oh my God.
Yeah. 10 straight years of this, by the way, with that character. I just have to wonder if it started wearing him down in real life.
Truly.
I mean, probably not.
I don't know. I was just going to say, I love how. And this is Friends forever, but it's like how just polar opposite Monica and Ross are.
Yeah.
Ross is just this whiny little mama's boy. And Monica's like, no, she's so like on her shit. So type A. So, but it just makes me laugh.
I just remember bumping into these guys during that time. Mm. And it was such a magical time for them.
Yeah.
The cast. I don't think they realized then, A, how good they had it, but B, I don't think anyone realized that it would go on so many generations. I knew Seinfeld would because I knew they were making I Love Lucy, but I didn't know this would go on the way it has and is going to continue to go on. But I remember Phoebe, Lisa, she was the one because she was a little bit older and so therefore a little wiser. And when they all wanted to leave and do more of their own projects, she was like, no, this is the best job in the world and we should stay another 10 years. We should ride this train as long as we can.
Well, and then anyway, the smart thing that to negotiate as a block, you couldn't pick off one or two of the friends and try and pay Chandler more
because
a lot of shows did that. I mean,
all the shows did that, not the same
quality, but that's exactly what happened in Three's Company. You know, was
they divide
Suzanne
and conquer.
Summers is getting how much? You know, and then you know it all falls apart as soon as that happens.
And they divide and conquer. Yeah, well, he was making a lot more Jack Tripper than
John Ritter.
Than
yeah,
she was, and she was an icon. So that was messed up.
But that kept them all like on Friends. It's like that kept them all.
It
like,
was
on such an
that's
equal
right.
Length.
And then that to this day, they're literally so such close. Good friends. Yeah. But back in the day, and again, precursor to millennial and Gen Z life. I feel like millennial and Gen Z, you guys are much. Yeah, you can be competitive, but more than us, you'll drop the competitive spirit to team up with one another, to have each other's backs. Mm-hmm. And I love that. These guys were the first. Seinfeld, none of them did that. Everyone is, you know, they're friendly. But to actually become friends, I think a lot of these people from Laurel and Hardy to Jack Klugman and Tony Randall, The Odd Couple, it seems like they all become friends after, years after, when they realize, my God, we've been through so much together. Mm-hmm. But during those times, it was always disappointing as a fan that they were never really close friends. But this group was, they got it. They were like, it's us against whether it's the fans or these executives. Like, we only understand what we're all going through. We have to pull together. And other shows since then, staffs have talent has done the same thing. and said, you know, one goes, we all go. And this is why, again, to get to economics of our business, you see so many multicast shows now, but they do that on purpose because you can be killed any week. Mm. You can be kicked off in any week. So it's really hard to keep your footing. But this was quite the precedent.
Yeah, and kind of revolutionary, it sounds like. No, that's a good digression.
Yes, it was. It was. And I'm happy for those guys. And by the way, wasn't it $1 million an episode they were each getting? Yeah. Not to mention what they get
towards
in residuals.
The end, yeah.
Towards the end.
Yeah.
I'll just name drop. Our neighbor is
Joey.
Matt LeBlanc. He's also Boston. He's from Newton, Mass.
So he's a neighbor. Hi. Him and his daughter were at the house. And this is me. Yeah. I look up and I go, oh, hey, Joey.
I would do.
I'm just like, it's like, I'm, yeah. And then
I
just like,
I would have done the same.
The look was like, hey, he just gave me the, and I'm, he's always at the sushi place near us. Yeah. Really, really nice guy and a great dad.
Well, and shout out to Matthew Perry. He just did his book and the whole Diane Sawyer interview. You guys should watch that. It's really, but he talks a lot
really
about
good
how,
interview.
Yeah. When he talks a lot about how he Jennifer cared. Aniston was there for him through that all and like how cool to have a co-star. You know, that you're working with every day while you're going through all this really dark stuff. So
I remember, and then
he also miscalculated how much America loves Keanu Reeves now. So you got to you have to be careful when you do those interviews. You know, he's Keanu Reeves is America's sweetheart, and you shouldn't be saying why is he still alive when River Phoenix.
Oh, is that what he said?
Wait, who Matthew said that?
Yeah,
Matthew Perry said that. Yes.
Said, why is Keanu Reeves still alive?
Well, yeah, it was more of like, you know, he picked a name out of a hat and he picked the wrong hat.
Oh, by saying I didn't Keanu even hear Reeves. That. Yeah. Yikes.
Yeah.
Okay, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, Keanu.
Happy Thanksgiving.
So Ross confirmed. Thank you, kid. So Ross confirms parents are gone. Joey announces he's going home. We learn that Chandler's going to boycott all pilgrim holidays. Phoebe celebrates Thanksgiving in December because it's lunar. And Rachel's going skiing.
Well, how progressive of Matthew Perry's Chandler to be boycotting the pilgrim holidays. Because as we discussed with the Charlie Brown Thanksgiving, like that's now kind of woke. So this was almost a predecessor of the woke culture. So that might be why the Gen Zers and millennials also, you know, tune into this. So yeah.
Carol,
he's not protesting it because of the history. He's protesting it in the most millennial Gen Z way possible.
Good point.
Yeah. Also true.
Me. Because I
had
like
a bad experience.
Yeah. It's Christian.
It was traumatizing.
It's so brilliant. So astute. Carol, the ex-wife, is not invited, but Ross stops by to see the pregnant ex-wife to pick up a skull, which is kind of funny. He notices a lot of books about being a lesbian. Which is an interesting mention. And we see a lesbian couple, which I think was very, very far ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
What was interesting was back then, having a wife leave you to marry someone of the opposite sex would be like, oh my God, like the biggest shock. And you would probably look at yourself that something was wrong with you. I think what they were going for is that, you know, Ross just can't get anything right. Whereas today, would it be as big a deal?
No, I mean, this was even before Ellen came out. That was such big news back in 97. I think it was 97. So yeah, this is totally unheard of. Where now, they're just a lesbian couple. I mean, no big deal.
When NBC originally presented Will and Grace on their upfronts, Will was just her friend. And they were like best friends. And they didn't really get into it. You know, so, you know, and I think that's actually after this. It's a crazy time to think about. And yeah, you're right, Kevin. This was very progressive for at the time because Ross makes jokes like, oh, you know, you have a lot of books about being a lesbian, but Susan has a great comeback. It's like, yeah, you have to take a course. Otherwise, they don't
Susan's
let you do
funny.
It.
Right.
She's very, she was the lead on, she was like one of the four leads on The Single Guy, that same actress, actually, which was one of the other Thursday night shows. Thing about, you know, the conversation about talking to the baby, that probably seemed crazy in 1994.
But, yeah, right.
I mean, I've had two kids. Well, my wife did. I talked to her stomach
now.
Both times.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's such a normal thing now. And that was another one of those moments. I'm like, yeah, I guess that would have seemed weird in 1994. Ross's reaction was probably everybody's reaction. It's like, you're reading to the baby that's not born yet? What are you, a crazy person?
Right. And so Elaine and Kelsey, when you see, a lesbian couple, well, when you saw this lesbian couple, let's say, and to you, what was your reaction? It's just normal. Or did it seem weird that he was reacting the way he did? Or
to the baby?
Well, not to the baby, but to the mentioning the lesbian books. Was that, did that interrupt your flow in any way, shape, or form, or just take it as a little joke and we're moving along?
No, I thought it was very progressive. Funny. I thought it was funny. I thought it was very progressive how Susan answered. I thought that it was a very not hurtful or harmful in any way. Like, just her answer was, I was like, oh, that was beautiful how they did that, because it's like, obviously he's so out of sorts. And I feel like how they wrote it for her to answer that, it like just put it right back into, no, it's good. It's fine. It's funny. Like, this is, we're all making light of it.
And this is why you guys probably just love, one of the more reasons why you love the show. Is it weird for you guys?
Earlier, I just want to interject, Kevin. I think a decade earlier, if in a similar situation, the show Too Close for Comfort, Jim J. Bullock would have just been the butt of a joke, wouldn't have had a great comeback, because he wasn't really gay on that show, but he was, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that at this point, they're like, well, no, we got to have a really good comeback, you know, for her. She's a strong character too. Ross can say what he says, but it's fine because Susan gives it just as well as she gets it. So I think that
empowering.
You know, I think, yeah, for 1994, this is very revolutionary almost. Yeah.
Yeah. To me, it's so funny how times change so fast. Even when I see the giant tube television, I see cassette deck, I see a phone on the wall. I mean, all that
stuff. CDs in those apartments.
Yeah. It all just went away in a blink.
Yeah.
In a blink. It's not like it was over time. It seemed like to me. And what's trippy is that fashion took a turn in 2000 where, starting in the mid-90s to 2000, where if you notice, you can look back at from 96 on and people don't look that different. I mean, there are things that stand out for sure, but the 70s has a distinct style. The 80s, a distinct style. The 90s does too, to a degree. I think that's what helps some of these shows hold up too, is because you look back at something in 2004 and you're like, you know?
I agree. Everything Monica and Rachel wear,
right?
We would all wear now.
Yeah.
Well, and we all wore then. We all got the Rachel haircut then. And, you know, everybody wore like the,
by the way,
little skirt with the tights. And, you know, and they basically were the fashion icons. Like, how they dressed on Friends is how you wanted to dress going out. And again, we all had the haircut.
I mean, even now, like, if, like, for my generation, you go on Pinterest and you're like, okay, I want to do a 90s style look today. And like, one of the first ones that pop up, it's Jennifer Aniston, or I don't know if it was her as Rachel or just Jennifer Aniston, just like wearing a little black dress with a white t-shirt underneath and her backwards baseball cap. Like, I think that was on the show, but like, that is an iconic look that people are still recreating right now with
so
my generation.
So Better Together and my wife have a deal with Macy's. So we do a lot of work with them. And the one thing that I noticed even last week, I said, you know, Maria, isn't it interesting that you can wear bell bottoms, or you can wear fitted jeans, you can wear mom jeans, almost anything. It's not like it used to be where it was distinctly only bell bottoms. It was distinctly only, you know, low cut jeans. Right now in women's fashion, she's like, oh yeah, everything's cool. So something I had noticed. All right, we're back at the apartment. Monica is prepping the turkey. Ross is complaining about talking to the baby. Phoebe talking inside the turkey, always being funny.
Rachel, tells Ross to stick his head in it.
Yeah, which is good. Rachel enters down in the dumps.
Wait, can we just go back to the singing with Ross? Because that was one of my favorite parts.
Oh, my goodness.
Singing the Monkees song.
Oh, wait a second.
That's later in the episode.
It's later. And will you just come on, stick with the program.
No, he was singing to the song.
Trust not your yet. Quarterback, not till later.
Not yet.
The reference to putting the turkey on Ross's head, of course, made some of us think to the later Thanksgiving episode. Yep. Where there wasn't a big furor over this at the time, but they literally stole the sequence from a Rowan Atkinson, Mr. Bean episode where he ended up with a turkey on his head. And I was just like, this is funny, but, you know, funnier the first time I saw it, you know, like a year earlier. But I guess they figured, that's British TV. Who's going to see that? But it did make me think about how much the characters kind of evolve over time, because, you know, they're like playing a football game later. And there's the one Brad Pitt comes over. So, you know, I was really like thinking of all of the other Thanksgivings as I watched this one. Like, this one is still pretty good, but you're like, oh, yeah, I think they get better after this.
Yeah. Well, this is our entry. This is our hors d'oeuvre. Well, we get snail mail, and we've talked about that on Charlie Brown, that, you know, it's so interesting to have a stack of letters, but one has money for her, which I think is really sweet and shows what great friends they are. Monica, being Monica, makes a nice little food baggie for
Ross.
Wait,
back to the money, though. It's the best when Ross is like, wait, we did? We all pitched in, and Monica's like, yeah, you owe me $20.
Yeah, which is typical, right? Like, typical. Of a guy, right?
That was a great line. Had to bring it up.
And she makes the bag up for Ross, and then Ross explains this is when his parents announced their divorce on Thanksgiving. And that's why he's...
Oh, no, for Chandler.
Chandler. Sorry,
yeah. The Funyuns and the grilled cheese mix that come in handy later. Yeah, that's foreshadowing. They want to let us know that they've got grilled cheese mixings in the house.
Mm-hmm. And you know, but going back to what you said, Christian, I didn't even think about the kind of gender stereotypes where Monica is cooking, she's responsible, she gives the money. The guy, that's so a guy's move to be like, did I give money? Yeah, you owe me $20. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, but at least their dynamic is brother and sister, and at least she's a cook. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So you're 100%
true.
Right.
True.
But it fits into the characters and their dynamic that, you know, oddly, Ross is her older brother. But when you think about those characters, that's really not the way they act.
But those stereotypes were really strong. That was the first thing I thought of when I was watching that scene with the two girls cooking and the guys like sitting there. Yeah, I'm like, whoa, this is definitely not of this time. You know, like we don't have that standard now. It'd be everybody in there cooking their own dish.
Yeah. Kelsey, did you see that too? Or
yeah, but I kind of agree with Christian. Monica being the
because
chef,
she's a chef.
It didn't bother
we
me.
We accept it.
Yeah.
That's her
the
trait.
The only thing that I was like, okay, is when everyone starts adding on their specific request, I was like, okay, now my mom would be like, cute, okay, you can come up and help me then, versus she was just like, okay, I'll do it all.
And right. I think that's just the type of character that Monica was. She was the right. mom of the whole group, and she wanted to take care of everyone, and sometimes she forgets about herself until she gets overwhelmed and she's like, okay, what about me, guys? What about me?
We cut to the subway and we've got Joey down there, and he meets a fellow spritzer from Macy's. By the way, lots of Macy's mentioned, so I wonder if they had to deal with them.
There's a package with a big Land's End logo in Susan's apartment, and I noticed that because I was like, oh, yeah.
Okay, so
there's
they had to deal with Macy's.
Definitely some way to spread the revenue around, yeah.
He makes his moves on her. What are you wearing? Nothing. When he asks her about the perfume she's wearing, nothing. Want to get a drink? And it's all going well. By the way, could anyone be picked up that way then or now?
Joey,
I think so.
I think I don't know.
If they look like
Matt LeBlanc and he was that cute,
yeah,
yeah,
that's my feeling.
Back then, honestly, yes.
Well, and he also didn't just like jump right into it. He was kind. He was like, "Hey, we work together." Like it was small talk. He wasn't creepy or weird. She was the one.
Again. Probably a little more progressive, right?
Truly.
Where she's making moves. By the way, she's a real
model.
She was a real, perfume model.
Perfume girl, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Model for some big campaigns as
There's
well.
She's the face of Geo and Ultima 2 and Oil Valet.
Nice.
Wow.
Now a psychotherapist, so a little bit of change of
interest.
Really?
Sides of the brain there.
Thank you, Anne.
Anytime, Kev.
I like that. Then she gets spooked and leaves him, and that's when he sees himself, the ad that he did as his first ad as an actor model is him in a venereal disease campaign, and he's horrified.
Which it's funny to think back on, like, oh, VD, how cute. What a thing to be scared of. VD,
I know, right?
Back in those days, you know?
Right.
But I had, of course, I always kind of remembered this as a gag in Friends. I didn't remember it being in the Thanksgiving episode. So to watch this one, I'm like, oh my God, this is when he ends up on all the posters. To License, Don't Stand So Close to Me from the police.
Yeah, so let's get into that.
Yeah.
So that was interesting to have a montage with a hit song. I mean, it's been seen before in sitcoms, but not often. And I thought that was very cool. And it was real shots of New York City with Joey's poster going up, which I also thought was nice. I always like when these things that are shot on sets are able to step out and film things in real locations. So I really love the montage with Don't Stand So Close to Me by the Police playing as we see the Joey VD poster literally go everywhere.
And it's one thing to have used that song when it was broadcast on network TV, but the fact that HBO Max and the DVD also has that song on it, that means that they really wanted to have that
song.
They
went all the way.
That's a lot of money to Gordon Sumner and Andy Summers and Stuart Copeland, you know, so they all get little checks every time somebody watches this episode of Friends.
You know, but you know, the counter is, and I'm sure they might be thinking that way as ours, so I'm sure their managers aren't.
Yeah.
If you're an artist, you want your song on this, not just because, oh, I would like to be part of the Friends thing and it's cool, but no, it's because new fans get to hear your music and say, wow, I like that. I'm going to go download it. I'm going to go buy it. Who played that? When the Sopranos used the Journey song for the last scene of the finale, that song went through the roof. If I'm an artist, you want your stuff on this. But again, managers and people in the middle, they want money. They don't care. But there's actual more money in letting productions like this have it, so it lives in perpetuity. So 20, 30, 40 years from now, more than likely someone will discover the police. Hopefully when we talk about Seinfeld, talk about Artie Shaw and big bands. You know,
oh, yeah.
I digress. What I thought was really cool is that you go to the coffee shop, and normally on a sitcom like this, you would get that montage, go to the coffee shop, it would fade down, you'd be out. What I liked is the music faded down, Joey enters, the gang's laughing, looking at newspapers and publications of him, laughing, and then the music cranks back up, which I thought was very bold, and they go back into the montage, and we see more posters being hung. And as a filmmaker, I loved it. I love that.
That was my single favorite part of the whole show. So I didn't connect that it was the dramatics of the music and all of that, but, and maybe because I was a fan of the police back then too, but I thought that was my favorite moment of the show. And Joey's face, I made it, but I didn't because this is a bad poster to be on. So he was feeling like all the emotions tied into one. He's like, there's my face. Oh, it's connected to VD.
I also like that Phoebe gets the line of, you know, laughter is infectious, and then they all laugh. They're very generous with sharing the jokes. I think a few years earlier, this show, Chandler would have had almost all the jokes.
You're right.
Like, that's great.
But they really, you know, each character has jokes that kind of fit who they are. And I don't know, it's like, it feels like an actual group of friends because the way that they're not afraid to make fun of each other, they all still love each other very much. You know, it's fine.
No, but it's also generous to the actors too, Christian, where everyone gets a line, and it's not, you're right. The old 70s and 80s sitcom, they would just dump it on the one funny guy and everyone else is set up. So I love it.
But, you know, you do see that in later sitcoms too. I mean, David Spade built a career on that and being the guy who kind of walks through a scene with the sort of the drive-by joke, you know.
Yeah.
But this show, I think, stands out even to this day. This and The Office, I think, are two shows that you think of where it's like, no, everyone can be funny at any moment and you just don't know when it's coming.
Balance and humor. Yeah, I agree. For sure.
We see the underdog float in the Macy's Parade. And by the way, if we have time and if we don't have time, we'll do it in a mini-sode. I have a lot to report on the underdog float, history of it, as well as the Macy's Parade. And it looks time-wise like that's going to be a mini-sode.
Kev, I can see you as a huge, there is no need to fear, underdog is here fan.
Oh, my favorite cartoon of all time.
I was singing the theme song all night after we started doing this. I'm like,
look, yes, we all grew up wanting to find our own Polly Pure Breed. And some of us were lucky enough.
You know what? I wasn't looking for her so much as I wanted the energy ring in the secret compartment of my ring. I fill with the underdog super energy pill. Okay, we're in the kitchen. We're getting requests for the tater tots, and we don't want lumps in our potatoes, as we said. And Chandler wants Rachel to stop shooping because she's got her tickets and she's excited. Shooping. Ross is off to the unborn child. And then Phoebe comes in and says, yeah, no lumps, but can you add peas and onions like my mom did before she died? So, of course, now she's got to accommodate that. Rachel leaves, and then Chandler rushes in and says, underdog has gotten away. Let's go. Off they go, where Ross is now with the ex-wife, who is a replacement actress for the first wife, because the first wife, Christian, was what cast? I think she got a lead in another series.
Susan was on another series. So when they did a crossover episode, one of the characters was just stuck in traffic, so they didn't have to try and put them both in the same scene. But this was a replacement actress for Carol. I don't actually know the backstory to that.
I think she got first Carol.
She got cast on something else, probably.
Yes. And so in comes this Carol, who's going to be the Carol that we'll see for the remainder of the series.
Rest of the series, yeah.
And now we go to Ross buying into talking to the unborn baby, and he's hilarious because he's telling his boring life story.
Oh my gosh. And then I picked this major. Right? So funny.
But now, Anne, they sing The Monkees, which I love. It's the Monkees theme song. So you probably didn't even know that, no. Kelsey, nor did you, Elaine, right?
That was just so classic because who didn't watch The Monkees back then? And then he changed the words. I thought that was brilliant. I mean, that was my second favorite part of the whole thing. I had already mentioned it before. Changing the words to the baby with the Monkees. You guys should go back and listen to the Monkees theme song and then rewatch that little clip because I think you'll appreciate it even more.
Yeah, I loved it too.
I love it when he wasn't going to do it. And then Carol was like, oh, well, okay then. Like, and he gets jealous about like Susan doing it. So he then is like goes in harder.
But see, we see why
she walks in and he's in song. It was great.
Yeah.
Well, this is why it's an apple and orange when you compare Seinfeld to Friends, because you know Friends has all these funny moments, but then we're going to see eventually the baby's going to kick. And there's a not really sweet moment between the three of them and sharing this moment, which is beautiful, but funny, but also a beautiful payoff. You would not have that on Seinfeld. It's a whole different show. We come back.
And because it has those moments of heart, because you understand, like, Ross, his legitimate fear is this baby is going to love its two mommies and it's not going to care about me.
Right.
And you see that in the moment. It's still very funny. But you know that you can sense that from the character, not just in this episode, but we're only talking about this episode. You can see it's a real fear. And he's motivated by, wait, the baby's going to like Susan more than me. I thought right. it was stupid to sing, but here I come with the monkeys theme. And I agree with Anne. That was
right. Great. It's so relatable to how we would respond in those moments. I don't want the baby to love anyone more than they love me. So I'm going to do whatever I can and sing to the belly, even though I don't believe that that's the thing. I'm going to do it anyways, because if there's a chance, then I'm on it.
And it was sweet then that the writers gave the kick to it kicked when Ross was singing.
Yes.
Too. I thought that that was a nice.
Yeah. So he could feel included.
Yeah.
It was great. We cut back to the apartment. They're locked out. None of the, of course, the boys have a key, but it's a box of keys and none of them are working.
Typical. Poor Monica,
her first Thanksgiving is ruined. Everything is burned. She's taking it personally. Ross enters, still singing the monkey theme. Now everyone's all yelling. They finally let in, but the place is smoky. Obviously the food is ruined. We cut to them all sitting stoic until they notice ugly naked guy cooking a turkey. Now, ugly naked guy is the person that they always, this mystery person that they see through their window. But then they notice he's having Thanksgiving with an ugly naked gal. And then everyone realizes how nice it is that even he has someone on Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. And we cut to the grilled cheese. They're all having grilled cheese. They're having their Thanksgiving with grilled cheese. They split a grilled cheese sandwich like they're splitting a wishbone. And then we get the Chandler toast, which is, this Thanksgiving has been great. I'm thankful that all your Thanksgivings sucked. And here's to a lousy Christmas and a crappy New Year. And so just a really clever, smart way to bring them all together and show them the meaning of Thanksgiving, which is they have each other, but not doing it in a way that's so sappy and corny and on the nose. My thoughts. But what do you guys think?
Yeah, and to take that even further, oh, that's so sweet. And then Ross is, and hey, here's to a lousy Christmas. And then Rachel is, and a crappy New Year. And they're all like, you know, ching, ching, and then here, here. So I liked how they extended that also.
Yeah, I felt all those things. And I also think that the make-a-wish on the grilled cheese, Joey has the perfect, most Joey joke.
Yes.
What'd you wish for? I mean, look, bigger half.
Like that's
Joey. So I mean, this is like what, the ninth episode of the series, and I'm just like, oh yeah, they knew who Joey was. You're still figuring out some of the other characters a little bit, but Joey was always Joey. You know, just his delivery on that was great. But you know, wrapped in a really like sweet moment, which, like you're saying, Kev, you would not have gotten anything approaching that in Seinfeld.
No, just different in different show. You know, so it's like, that's why it's not unfair to compare them. You guys, we went an hour on this. We went a long time. And what is our text number if you want to text us suggestions?
Thanks, Kev. Our text number is 351-251-2511. That text number again is 351-251-2511.
Thank you. And go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe. Leave us a five-star rating, please, and your comments. Oh, I don't know. After that, tell a friend. Keep listening. We'll be dropping more stuff as the march to the Christmas and New Year holiday happens.
Continues.
Yes, it continues. I think we probably may have a little bit more Thanksgiving love in us before we just go full Christmas on you.
Full scent Christmas.
Hopefully you're preparing now as we speak. We've got our tree up here in the house where we obey the Mariah Carey rule. November 1st is the official beginning of the holiday here. Hopefully the rest of you are doing the same. Christian, when do you have kids? So when do you start the march?
We start, you know, my friend Will Sterling, who I've done my podcast, The Blackcast, with for years. He has had this thing that he calls Joy to the World Day, November 1st. He listens to Christmas music that day. And we adopted that. Also, this year, SiriusXM, very smart. Their Halloween channels went right over to Christmas channels. There was no in between this year. So on November 1st, we do the music. We don't do the tree until Thanksgiving weekend. One of the days in there is when we actually decorate. It stays up a little bit longer. We're not ready to say goodbye because we have a fake tree. Yeah, the kid and my daughter's birthday is right after Thanksgiving. So we have a little bit more focus on that, but there's already a lot of talk about Christmas and the decorations will be out later this month.
Love it.
Very nice.
Wow.
And what, Kelsey, what about your family?
My mom is a let's get our tree a week before Christmas.
Wow. Put it old up. School.
Oh, yeah. Take it down the day after the Boy Scouts come and get it. She's like, nope, get it out.
Wow. Bye.
She'll decorate. Like, we're very, like, she likes to cook and she likes the candles, but the tree, she's like, uh-uh. And my sister is all about the real tree. Erica, like, will not have it unless we have a real tree.
Yep.
So my mom's like, okay, great. Go get it. Go figure it out. So that's my mom.
All right. I'm the son of a fireman, so we never could have the real tree. We always had fake ones. All right, Anne, what about your family?
Depends on where, but this year, so my mom and dad will put up their tree slowly. So they have the fake tree, kind of old school 70s, like it's a fire hazard. Even though they weren't firemen, they're still like, we're not too many needles on the floor. It's going to be a mess. So it's the one with like the color coded, you know, you put the branches in. So it'll go half up one day. My mom will get, you know, she's 84, so nothing's super fast. And then little, she's into those Byers carolers, which are like the Scrooge characters. So those go up, a couple of decorations. And then old school till the 6th of January.
Yeah, I like January
60th. Comes down.
Nice job, Mom.
Yep.
And my mother's done the.
Can I just tell you a funny thing here? So I take care of my now 96-year-old mother-in-law who hates the Christmas tree. So when we first started taking care of her, she was like, I hate those Christmas trees. They're such a mess, et cetera, et cetera. Welcome to my world. And so I went out to Home Depot and got one of those yard reindeers that we call Clyde. And that is now our tree in Florida at my mother-in-law's house.
I threw the
tree skirt around as a scarf. I'm like, you're not killing my Christmas
tree. Does she love it?
She tolerates Clyde. I'll give it a tolerate. It's better than the tree with the needle.
That's so funny.
What about you, Elaine?
So I'm an only child, and my mom is like the only person that lives in Washington. And my mom is so minimalistic. She does not like to do big holiday things, but I do like the holidays. So the moment I get back, whenever I have a full day, I put up that tree. And the day before I leave, I take it back down.
Nice.
God, I good representing.
I got
my mother's been. My mother's done the tree reduction program. So every year, I swear to God, it just gets smaller and smaller. Now it's a tabletop one that probably is a foot high.
I'm not
kidding. It just keeps going down. And it's kind of
the tree reduction program is perfect.
Right? You guys, we look forward to your comments and your thoughts. We will see you next week.
Let's go.
Onward, Vixen, onward.
Well, I still have a little magic. Oh, I'm not such a loser after all.